Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain. Tony is still recovering from an illness earlier, and Sean's been with me for the last few weeks or so and doing a wonderful job. So Sean McNally is with us. Laurie and Sergeant, John Ryder, Billy Beard and Sean McNally. Face to face, and Sean's my compadre in the interview, and much appreciated because he has gone through all your stuff. And this is part two because we had a great week last week, but we had to continue because you got so much inside you guys that need to come out. And Sean's got to all the questions this week, and we're leaving it all to him. So take over, young man.
No pressure at all. Hey, guys, thanks again for making the time for round two. I do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
So basically, to anybody who's listening, I would encourage you to go back. We had our first interview with these guys last week, and some good information on there. Unfortunately, Angelo is still busy on a gig, so he's not able to join us today. So who knows? Maybe we'll do a third version at some point. But just to kind of pick up off last week, and then we can go back and go over a couple different things if you guys don't mind. First of all, we didn't get into the genesis of the band. Please tell me who wants to volunteer this. How does New Hampshire College fit into the mix of how this band forms?
Well, so it's New England College, to be specific.
New England College, sir.
New England College, which is in Henniker, New Hampshire.
The only Henniker on earth.
The only Henniker on earth. So I graduated from high school a year ahead of time and was not prepared in September to go off to college. So I applied to a bunch of schools and then wound up going to Henniker in January of that year. And Angelo had already been there for a semester. And when he entered the second semester, I believe, was when he went to England. He was in Arundel at a sister campus of the school. And when he came back, I went to, it was a sort of impromptu concert in one of the dorms. And I saw this guy play. It was the first time I'd ever seen him. And he was doing a duo set with another guy. And I was just floored. I had grown up playing drums and being basically in a cover band. I had one original band before that. But when I saw him perform, I just felt like it was magical, and I sort of wanted to get involved. And it turned out he had already kind of started a band, and I was more interested in pursuing guitar at that point. I'd been playing drums since I was 8, and I was sort of tired of it. But they didn't need another guitar player. They needed a drummer. So I went back home to New York, and I got my kit, and I came back up to New Hampshire. And we started a band in Henniker and played there all throughout the rest of our college career. And it's sort of that band split up, but I stayed in touch with Ange, and I had a job at a advertising agency for a little while doing graphic design. And the phone rings one day and he says, "Beardo, been thinking about this. I can't believe we're not even trying. We're going to turn 30 and never really tried for the music biz." And I quit my job a day later, and I moved over to Concord, New Hampshire. And we sort of got the band together and woodshedded in a house there, and eventually moved to Boston, I think in maybe late 79, early 80, somewhere in there. And we had a different singer at that point, and she made it in Boston for about 6 months and said she was going to quit. So she was out. And at this point, Stu, who was in the band, he said, "I remember there was this girl, I gave her guitar lessons up in New Hampshire." And it was, Stu was a townie that lived in the neighboring town of Henniker. And he was a few years younger than us, so he was still a high school age when we were there. But already established as a great guitar player, and he had his own band called the Stu Review. And they were sort of competition for our college band. But eventually we got together, and anyway, he remembered this this woman, Lori Sargent, who he had been giving guitar lessons to. And Lori, you should take it from there.
Stu reached out to me and told me that Face-to-Face, who I, you know, worshipped because they were a little older. And in my mind, as a townie from a small town of Hopkinton in New Hampshire, I just adored them. And Stu had been giving me guitar lessons. And he said that Paula Dudley had was quitting the band and they were holding auditions. And I can't believe they made me audition, but they did.
That was awful. We went through like 30 singers and we had this one microphone for them. And they all came in all sort of dressed up to be stars. And so there was this disgusting ring of red lipstick on the front of the microphone. And they were awful. There were a couple of good ones, but they were generally awful. And then Laurie came in. It was like, God. You know,
so the bar was low.
Yeah.
It was a low bar, and I got the job, and it changed my life, and I'm very thankful. It was between me and, they narrowed it down between me and one other woman, and I still don't know who voted for who, but I have my suspicions.
The other woman was an ex-Playboy bunny.
You made a good choice, guys.
Really good choice.
Oh, so that was kind of how the band started, and then it was just a question of getting, because Lori was still living in New Hampshire, so she had to move down and get the wheels rolling with local gigs. And back then, it was like, I don't know, Jonathan Swift's and In Square Men's Bar, and you pick up your supporters along the way that help push it along. And we certainly,
but eventually we got in with a good agent, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was Howie
Case.
Pretty Polly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty Polly was a major, major player, in that time frame. I forget if I mentioned this in the first call, but I was, when I was at Northeastern in the mid 80s going to school, I was like on the concert committee there, and I was booking most of the shows with the, you know, committee of people. And, Howie was kind of the go-to, not just for like you guys, like for local bands. And he monopolized that whole market. He was very smart in that respect, honestly, because he knew the colleges had more money to spend on bands than they probably should have.
Yeah.
And the budgets were a lot bigger for schools versus a club gig. So it really made sense to try and take advantage of that. And he was great with that. So I can just tell you several shows I booked. Like I did like... Stevie Ray Vaughan at the old hockey rink at his arena, and then Treta Wright played on the show with Little Feet there. I got them from both from Howie, and I also had John Cafferty Brown Band played on that Stevie Ray Vaughan show, and numerous others. We had the Neighborhoods, the Outlets, all kinds of bands from Boston were playing there, and it was a great thing going on there with Pretty Polly, and then that went on for quite a while. Actually, he was kind of the main guy to go to for acts.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he got me lots of shows in the 70s in Hennecker College, mm-hmm. where you were, and all that stuff. We did the Birds in there. And Howie got all kinds of shows for us. And it was just just unbelievable character, too. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, he's very smart.
Howie and Gary Habib.
Oh, wow.
Gary was the other guy in the office.
He worked with
us for a while. Yeah. And another weird coincidence about New England College and Hennecker was that we recently lost a local great guy in David Johnston. And he was, when I registered for classes that first semester, he was the guy standing in line right in front of me. And we became fast friends. And then later, Carter Allen worked at the college radio station.
Wow.
And he became our roadie and a sound tech. We used his van all the time. So it was kind of funny.
It's so cool. So we always comes back to this like, it's kind of a weird scene. It's like this Boston music scene is big, but it's really small insular when you think about it. Just people just kind of, it's a very small city compared to other major markets in this country. But for what we had that time, my God, I think it'll go against anybody in the country, if not the world, for the best scene of the talent and this support system with the radio and the Phoenix and the college radio and the, there's so many clubs you could play back then. It was a cheap cover. It was cheap to live in Boston. It was just all the things were there to really make it an unbelievable scene at the time. We just didn't realize it at the time. So we were talking last time too about like memories of shows that maybe didn't play there, but when you attended shows like a fan, or maybe you were helping out Roadie in the band. But I'm looking at your story, Billy, from you last week. Any bands or shows you remember from the channel that you attended as, you know, just as a fan, or someone wanted to go there and check out a different band?
You know, I think the Neighborhood's probably like one of the best shows I've seen there. Sure. I remember a memorable night. I went to see Jesus and Mary Chain at some point, and just for curiosity's sake. And I remember walking in and listening for about an hour, and I felt like I had a splitting headache. I hated it. I wanted to get out, and I left. And I passed Brett Milano, and as I passed him, I go, "Oh my God, it gave me like the worst hangover ever." And he goes, "Yeah, but it was such a beautiful hangover, wasn't it?"
That's a great. That's great. That's so funny.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
And again, if anything pops up during the call, guys, feel free to step up and say something, because we always have a tendency to trip over different memories and it might trigger something else. But we did talk about the whole recording process before, and how that third album, the final one, One Big Day, was probably, you know, if not your best, I would think the most honest record, with like the truest sound of what the band was, or what you guys had become at least. And I had heard that Polly Graham did want to do a second record with you guys, which would have been your fourth record, but it didn't come together, right? And I'm just kind of curious why, and any of you can take this question, as far as like, was it just time, or you just didn't feel they were going to do a good job with the record? I'm kind of curious to know why that fourth record never came to fruition, so to speak.
No one, I have no recollection of Polly Graham wanting to do another record with us. If they, in my experience and what I recall, Polly Graham was never interested in us as a band. They signed us, and then, you know, we had been told that there was a rumor going around the label, like that they were going to tank us. I mean, they did nothing, not one thing for us. So that's why, in my opinion, somebody else might have a different memory, but they tanked us.
Wow.
You know, like even I was so excited when we made that record, because the River radio station had just come up and they were playing women. And it was like they were playing as many women, if not more, than men, which was a whole new thing. And I was like, yes, we have a, you know, actually, I think this was when I made my record, so never mind. It wasn't, they hadn't started yet. I take that back. Just delete that part. But anyway, I don't take back that Polly Graham. You know, like we were offered decent tours, you know, as opening acts, and they wouldn't fund a tour for us. And So if there had been someone there that wanted us, it would have been nice if they had spoken up.
Does anybody else have a different recollection? Because I picked it up somewhere on the line. Maybe I read it on a board somewhere, but I could have sworn they did want to do a record. Billy, did you have any other idea about that?
Never heard of that. Never heard of that before.
Wow.
I heard of it.
You did?
I did.
You just didn't tell the rest of us?
Yeah, you didn't.
No, I think that things had progressed, I think, where our involvement with Jeff Kramer, with management, with everything that was going on, I think Dick Wingate at some point said we could still do another one. And I think it was just, to me, it felt like time. It was done. It was like, we didn't get support from the label. We were, you know, you're just piling on debt on top of debt. You could never get out of it, no matter what. And I seem to remember that, but
it's weird.
Dude, are you on a wireless? Are you on a wireless? You seem to go digital there for a minute.
No, I'm on my mobile.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You got
kind of. We lost the last minute there, Billy.
Really good stuff.
So it always is. So I mean, so Billy, did you have like a better I mean, I'm just curious. Like, if it seemed like the word kind of got to you, but maybe not everybody else, that hey, there's still interest, and then you guys should
come. I don't think, my recollection is it wasn't put out like, hey, come on, you guys, let's do another record. I think Dick Wingate, who was running things at that point, and Jeff Kramer were like, we'd be willing to go in one more shot.
Gotcha.
And it just didn't feel in my mind, it didn't feel honest. Like, it felt like a desperate last move somehow. Like, I just didn't feel like we had the support of that label.
No, it makes sense completely. It makes sense completely. That's interesting. Very interesting.
It's interesting they didn't support you. You know, at them days, they were supporting everybody that they could. Mm-hmm. Today, you can't get a dime from them. They make you sign your life away and make you sign for your writing royalties. And now they've gone into all the stuff, the merchandise. They've got to have merchandise money. Mm-hmm. And it's just got out of control. And they're not backing bands anymore like they used to at all. It's
they weren't backing bands then either. They were backing bands that were connected to the current trends.
Yeah, that's
you know,
a good,
that,
good
that
point.
Hadn't changed. It wasn't just point. Throwing money around. They, you know, if you sounded like Michael Jackson or Cyndi Lauper or Bon Jovi, or you know, if you could slot in with one of those, the job was easy. They get you out to radio stations. Nobody had to think. Nobody had to take any risk, and so that was easy. But if you want to have your own voice, and then you just had to like gig relentlessly until the public demand was so high that they kind of had, you had to create your own buzz.
Yeah, that's the truth. That's it. That's what's gonna do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure especially after your first record, there the whole deal with, you know, fly to LA and then we're ready. We're so anxious, and it just delays. It's just like, it's amazing how powerful in a way labels were or could be if they wanted to be, if they really wanted to get behind a band. If you had like a real champion, at least a real champion on the inside that could really fight for you, it made all the difference in the world. You know, otherwise, if you're playing different departments, you said, oh, we can't market this band, or how are they going to, oh, they're not this, they're not that, how are we going to do it? And it just kind of gets put in the side, and then it drags and drags, and here you guys out there just, and can't wait till you're going, and you're just like, come on, what are we doing? What are we doing here, right? So I can totally understand the frustration, the whole record industry back then, for sure. So that makes sense.
It's like Jenga. There are so many little tiny things that have to align and stay that way for the whole structure to be strong. Management, players, writers. You know, that's one thing that set us apart from all of our contemporaries. I'll say it here: is we had the writing. You know, we had songs, we had content that was serious, you know, and so that's what put us apart from all the others around us. Some guys had great shows, some guys had great soloists, some bands had great whatever, but we had all of that, plus we had the best content. We had, look at Angela's lyrics in those first couple records, and Lori's, she started writing, and she wrote, you know, Place Called Home and Grass Grows Greener. On that last record, those songs still hold up today. Those are great songs.
Absolutely. I
mean, yeah.
Absolutely. 100%. It's excellent stuff,
I think,
for sure.
I think, too, though, to add to it, you know, it's funny how you forget a lot of this stuff, but it became such a big deal of, like, what bin are we going to put that record in? Is that a rock record? Is it a dance record?
Yeah.
Is it now like a country record? It's like, I think we had sort of dabbled in all of it. And by the time we were hitting our stride with One Big Day, it was sort of the Americana thing hadn't happened yet. Or it was just teetering on the edge of happening, alt country, whatever. And it was, I think that was clearly where Ange was leaning, and probably me too. But I think that became a real detriment.
You're right. And it's funny like that, Bill, you said, I remember seeing you guys listen to the Christian band at one point. Just how do you not everybody falls into a perfect, you know, bin, so to speak, right? So it's
right.
And unfortunately, I think that is part of, you know, you want to give labels some credit, but at the same point, it's like, I don't think they know how to handle certain bands. They just don't.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's a shame because it's like, there's a buzz about this band. They're really great. We love this and that about them. And then, you know, here come the marketing heads, here come the promotion people, and here come the, you know, and it's just like, okay, how are we going to push this band? And if there's someone that, you know, high enough up that just doesn't get it, it's just, you're like almost doomed. It's such a shame. It's such a shame, you know? It happens to so many bands.
Yeah, and I think it's the push-pull between the artistry coming from within the band and the opposite end of that, of the commercial desires of the label.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I really respect bands that were able to sort of stick to their guns, and this is just what we do, and this will just leave a body of work. And I think for us, it was, you know, the thing that we talked about Gordon Perry last week, who was working with Jimmy Iovine, and his whole expression all the time was, you got to get on base. You just got to get on base. Doesn't matter what you do. Just got to get on base. Yeah. And it's like, it kind of does matter what you do. And it matters how the band synthesizes all of that. You know, it's really hard when other voices are whispering in your ear that you should do this or you should do that. You know, I always
we kind of did get on base. We had a top 40 hit. We had this Hollywood movie, but then like anything else, some people heard 10 and 8 and they stuck us in that bin.
Right.
Yeah. And there was nothing to do with us and the rest of that. Right. And then that movie was like something else altogether. And so there was nothing that we could do that was us that was going to be able to leverage any of that. So
exactly.
Yeah.
It's frustrating, man. Well, I can just tell you, you guys, to me, you guys left quite a legacy. I mean, to this day, I listen to all three releases, and plus the live stuff that John put out from the Metro show, anything that I have that has you guys on it, it holds up today to me. I mean, I think, and especially the last record, I think that was really, like you were saying, Bitter, there was not really a thing known as Americana at that point, but you guys pretty much, I'm gonna say inventing, but you guys were doing it. And it's like, I think 5 years later, it might've meant the difference in the world for you guys, you know? But you know, everything's about timing, right? So let's talk about some other things. Well, actually, before we go to other shows and all that, what about? Do you guys each have a favorite like song or album you worked on for different reasons, or just to perform it? You perform it live. Anything you want to like share about that?
There's things I like about each of the records. I mean, I like them better. I like the third record better than the first record. That kind of thing, overall. But there's aspects of each that I think are pretty good, and I'm proud of. But one little pump for this this Live at the Metro record, by the way, that Stu and I put together a couple of years ago. It's available on all your streamers. So if there's any fans that want to hear some live stuff, it was a show we did for King Biscuit on BCN at the Metro around 86. So none of the One Big Day material, but anyway, we're pretty proud of that. Hey, we're pretty good. We played pretty well together.
Killer version of Tell Me Why on that.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah. And Reckless Heart.
Yeah.
And, any number of them could be your favorites. And there's a couple things on there that weren't released ever. So go to your favorite.
That's a very good release. Anybody who's a fan of the band, definitely look up online. You can find it Live at the Metro.
Yeah. Face to Face Live at the Metro. You got to stay Live at the Metro or else you get a million other face to faces.
Yeah.
Live at the Metro. So anyway, here's my little plug. Thanks for.
But Laurie, about you, are there any songs that like kind of stick out to you? It surprised you that didn't pick up more, or that you just really performed and thought it was a great song and enjoyed it? I mean, it's easy to say I love all my kids, right? I'm just curious if you had a song or two that really kind of either stuck out to you as being the perfect fit for the band, or you just really enjoyed performing it live, or anything like that.
There was a song on. It's not necessarily my favorite song, but it was one of my favorite things that happened to make the recording, which was that Cyndi Lauper came in and sang on a song called The Fourth Watch. And Cyndi Lauper, for people who think that she's a ditzy, is one of the most amazingly powerful and versatile singers I have ever heard. And she came in, and she's also very small. She's short and small and... She comes in and just wails on this song. I still get goosebumps when I remember what it was like to be standing with her at the microphone, and just her belting this song out. It was really great. She was like, but Lori, no one's going to know what The Fourth Watch is. Like, you can't say this song.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's an incredible talent. Incredible talent. That's awesome. I didn't know. That's a great story. That's awesome.
Oh, she's an amazing singer. What you hear on her records is about 10% of her actual skill.
Oh, yeah. All the stuff after girls just want to have fun with. Just go back and listen to all of her stuff since. It's been fantastic.
She can do many octaves. She's really good at that.
Yeah, she does have many octaves, and she can use overtones in her voice.
Yeah, that's the
note at once, and.
That, you got it, Laurie. She can do the overtones. I like that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
And she
was a label mate and became sort of a mentor to us for a year or so.
Very cool. Billy, how about you playing behind the band? What songs do you like to perform live or just kind of had a special meaning to you, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think on that last record, A Place Called Home, but there's another song on there called A Change in the Wind. Mm-hmm. And that to me was like, it's so poignant. It's so spot on for now to me. And I loved playing it. And it was interesting because the last record was Anton Fear, who's, you know, an incredible drummer. So it was being introduced to a lot of things that I had not been introduced to. And he was a troubled soul, but he was a great inspiration in a lot of it. Great. So I really liked that. I liked making the last record.
Anton had the best puke face expression. Like if we played something and he didn't like it, we would finish playing and turn around and look through the glass, and he would just be sitting there with his face like.
His fingers would walk up his chest and hold his nose. Remember that?
Can you take some of these songs that you have from all three albums and from the live stuff and do a compilation on that? You know, the stuff that's really, really good off of them. Is it possible for you to do that and put an album out with all those particular songs on it that just all of you love, you know?
It's hard to track down ownership. I mean, I've heard some horror stories of people trying to get their stuff reissued. And I don't know if you guys have looked at this route at all, but I mean, I've heard horror stories from bands trying to go back and recreate or find their old tracks or reels, and it's just non-existent, or you just can't find anybody to talk to.
Yeah.
Well, the good thing is that Dick Wingate is an industry expert on digital rights.
Mm-hmm.
He signed us in both labels, although nobody at either of those labels exists anymore.
Right.
And nobody that ever worked there is working there.
And there was no digital at that time. It was all analog still. So it's
no, well, One Big Day was on a CD. We recorded everything analog.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you did have at least one record that was reissued in the last, I don't know, decade or so, right, on a CD?
Both of the first two were reissued at some point.
I think from out of Japan. There was
That would make sense.
CDs.
Yeah, the Epic ones, Epic Sony.
Yeah.
They did, something got sold, and so then they sent us all forms, release forms. That's all I remember.
But I just looked it up. Yeah, I think you're right, Billy. It's a Japan Epic Sony company called Wounded Bird Records.
Yeah, exactly.
How apt.
No, yeah.
Wounded Bird.
I think they weren't dead birds. So, that was reissued in 2006, actually. So I guess you can, you know, if you want to dig, you might be able to find the CDs out there, but they are pretty rare even then. Let's talk about, like, live show memories. I mean, we did go over a bunch of the channel stuff. It's some pretty historic stuff you guys did there. The video shoot, obviously. You headlined a bunch of gigs. You had people, like, New Man was a common opener for you guys. Digby Fignis. There's a bunch of shows over the years. Rick Berlin, obviously, was a big fan of you guys. Skin. You know, any like channel, you know, memories? I know you guys had a couple of New Year's Eve gigs, which is, I think you were actually the only band twice on New Year's Eve, actually, which is pretty cool.
I have a couple. One of them was, I had my my Harley days back. You know, I was riding this beautiful black Harley I had, and Chachi Lepret, the promotions guy from BCN, had this little TV show going on down some studio in Norwood. We arranged for me to be, I was on my way to a sound check actually, and there we were. I come up from Brighton and I go and get up the ramp, and we're going down the central artery, and I'm riding right next to his driver's door, and he's got the window down. He's got a cameraman in the passenger seat.
Oh, wow.
And he interviewed me. He asked me like three questions by the time we got to South Station.
I like
did an interview like that.
Touchy.
That's a good memory for sure.
What could go wrong?
Yeah.
So, John, Marianne Faithful was at the channel, right?
Right, yeah. That was great memory that was. Yeah. She was incredible. I met her through some mutual friends and sat down for coffee one time in Porter Square at the Dunkin' Donuts, and along the Muzak coming through, and she's telling me stories about, you know, hanging with Jimmy and Mick, you know, her friends, and she's telling me these stories, and the Muzak overhead starts playing this generic version of As Tears Go By.
Oh, wow.
And we just looked at each other and her face just kind of fell. You know, like, isn't this sad? Anyway, at that point, we were on our way to a rehearsal over in Fresh Pond at the rehearsal space that we had. So she rehearsed with us, I think, once or twice, maybe once. And then we had
Broken English had already come out, right? That was kind of
Broken English was long, long out.
Yeah.
It was already a come and gone. It was her biggest song. And so we played that, and we played another one. It was a difficult reach for me as a bass player. I remember that. But we did these two songs, and it was the first time she hadn't performed in like 3 or 4 years at that point. So she was a nervous wreck. But when she walked on the stage, in fact, when she walked on the stage at rehearsal, you know, mm-hmm. she just got this command presence, and we all kind of had to, ooh, yeah, we got a new boss. You know? You could just tell. And when she walked on stage at the channel, it was like the place got, it was like church all of a sudden. We had royalty mm-hmm. with us. And we knocked those songs out. It was just brilliant. The whole thing kind of, the whole place felt elevated.
Had she been dramatized in that show, John? Did she just kind of show up?
I don't think so.
No.
Amazing.
No. I think that we weren't supposed to advertise it, but the word got out because I remember somebody, a big wig in the Boston music scene that would probably never have come to a face-to-face show, was begging for a spot on the guest list. The show was sold out, and he knew that she was going to have a guest appearance, and I think it blew a lot of people's minds, including ours, that Marianne Faithfull was standing on stage with us. It was really cool.
That's awesome. Awesome.
I'm glad
before we get back to the channel, so you guys mentioned like, kind of like brushes with greatness. So obviously, Cyndi Lauper falls in that chart. Anybody else you guys did either collaboration in the studio or maybe on your tours? And I know, for example, like The Alarm, I know Mike Pierce is a big fan of you guys. Do you guys have any kind of you either join bands on stage during tours or any kind of special memories? Someone joined you guys on stage?
We had a special guest when we were recording the demo of a song for our last record, named Steven Tallarico.
Oh, yeah. Sure. One and only.
Yeah, it was really, really, really fun and such a dream come true for me to stand literally like right next to him. It was like we were conjoined twins and singing to the same mic on a song, you know, that I had co-written with Angelo. And it was just, yeah, it was amazing. He was another, like, just like Cyndi Lauper, he is just an astounding vocalist, and the power that emanates from his body while he's singing is tangible. It's really, it was amazing. So that was
what song was that, Lori?
It was a song called Ever Since Eve. We put it on, you know, between the time that we recorded the demos at a place that we used for our demo recording called Pyramid Sound in downtown Boston. It was owned by a wild character named Gene Bodio, who had a giant Rottweiler named Moose. the things you remember, but...
you're saying that you don't remember anything. It depends on
Jim. Yeah, I remember the useless things. Like, I remember the Rottweiler's name. I mean, hello, like, what? Where's that going to get me? But anyway, a lot of time passed between when we did the demo, and then Anton ended up being our producer, and he was not that into the, you know, trying to put Steven on our record because we had gone in such a different direction. You know, in the end, it became sort of really much more Americana. Mm-hmm. But it's a huge regret of mine that we didn't use him on the record. I think it was a really big mistake.
Was that just your call? Did the label not want to do it? Or they couldn't credit him?
Well, the label would have had to pay. They would have had to pay. And then Steven's label would have had to allow it.
Yeah.
And at the time, they would just, you know, he was trying to write for, what was it, Permanent Vacation or something? And then by the time we were ready to release, he was already out on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And they were making what would be their biggest record to date.
Yeah, the monster record, no question. Yeah. Wow, that's cool. That's too bad it didn't work out that way. That would have been pretty cool.
That's, you know, what bummed, you know, what frost my cake is that they ended up not, you know, I was hoping, you know, if we could get him on the record, we could open the tour, we could get, you know, all this exposure. But instead, they found some unknown band out of some L.A. bar and they took them with them, and it was called Guns N' Roses.
Wow. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
I remember those days for sure. They were coming up big time at the point, at that point.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I'll tell you this. In all the years that have gone by, and I can think of channel shows and think, oh, that felt really good. I remember that. That was so much fun. Or we had a freaking insane party afterwards, whatever.
Yeah.
It wasn't until that movie showed up. I think John, where did that come from? Who shot that, John?
So like 20 years later, not 20 years, 15 years, 20 years, whatever. A long time later, I'd gotten married. I had a daughter living in Westboro. And my daughter's in junior high. So she's, 11, 12. And she says, hey, Dad, my lunch buddy, this girl that wasn't one of her friends, it's just somebody she ate lunch with pretty much every day. Her name is Susie Speed. I thought, wow, does she have a brother named Billy Quaalude? Her name was Susie Speed, and she says, this my lunch buddy's dad played a show with you, and I was like, oh, really? That's nice. And so eventually, it got to like we exchanged numbers, and I called this guy up. He worked over in Hudson, and so he said that his lead singer's wife was walking around with a little compact video camera, one of those things with the size of a Fender amplifier on her shoulder, this giant, and she was walking around. She videotaped like they were the first of like three bands, and then she videotaped all of ours. And
and it was our last show.
It was our last show.
It was our final show at the channel.
He wanted some on YouTube. Was it her video?
Yeah, all those. That's it. Yeah.
Oh.
And so I burned him some CD songs on a CD that he wanted, and he gave me a copy of that video. And so I chopped it into little bits and posted it on YouTube.
Wow.
That's what Billy
that's what you wish, man. That's I wish we could have recorded that with an actual camera crew, knowing what it would be the last one, especially, But that's at least footage exists, which is pretty great,
And a 24.
There's a lot of, most of the shots are from side stage.
Yep.
And you can't really see a ton, but I will say it blew my mind. Like that was a good band. we were firing on all cylinders right then and there. And, I was like kind of shocked how good it was.
Yeah.
That was the same thing. There's actually some documentation because that would be what a find that would have been after so many years. That's pretty awesome. And that was great.
Yeah.
That's what Sue and I did. We got those 24 tracks. He had them in a storage thing for 30 some years.
Wow.
And I had some, I was having a good year financially. So I said, let's get them. So we got them. And I found a guy in New Jersey that you had to know somebody. And so I got shipped him this box full of these 2-inch reels. And he baked them really slowly.
Yeah.
What you do with old tapes, you bake them really slowly and you run them on this machine. And he sent me back a couple of thumb drives and
you only got one shot at it, right?
Yeah. At that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then the tapes, he said, you want the tapes back? I said, no.
The oxides,
we got the files.
The oxides could drop off. And if it's a 456, tape, Ampex, it will do that at that time period. Would drop out. And, going back to something that you guys did talked about in Japan, if you guys had cassettes from that time period, they sell in Japan for ridiculous amounts of money, $75 a cassette.
Wow.
I mean, it's
just, our road manager threw them all out.
Oh, man. that is a prize to them. Because somebody
just walked up to me and handed me a promotional cassette of the One Big Day record.
Wow.
Like a year ago, and it's just sitting here on a shelf. Mm. Give me $75, you can have it.
See, that's it. Yeah, it's just one of them thoughts. I mean, there's so much out there that can be used, especially that time period. They love that time period and stuff. And,
yeah, very like us.
In Europe right now, I mean, people like John Butcher and Barrons is absolutely a monster in Europe, and he's doing his thing from the 70s and 80s and doing an incredible job still. and they all come out to see him and stuff, including Robert Plant. He came to see them.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, I'm doing a gig with Berenson and John Butcher coming up. Next month.
Well, Sean did one down here last week with them down at the Spire, and I popped
it. I've got one at the Mid East. It's the Middle East. Is that where?
Oh, the Middle East.
Yeah, yes, sir. Middle East in June. Yep, Middle East downstairs. Yeah,
that's cool. And unfortunately, we just lost one of the guys who owned that place. I mean,
yeah.
Wonderful.
His wake was very, very well attended for sure. It was very, very nice to see. Not surprising at all.
So have you got anything planned from all the past that you put together as a compilation that you can do? That's what I'm trying to get at, because you've still got a lot of material that never really saw the light of day except for a few people. And it's good material. It's good stuff. Sean won't be raving about it. I mean, come on, he's a heavy metal dude. <and stuff>. He wouldn't be raving about
it. Wide variety of musical taste. And these guys are definitely part of that for sure. So.
See, there
well, that live tape that we found at Remix, that's pretty much it. There's no more material floating around. There was nothing, I don't think, from one big day other than some demos. I mean, I've got some demo things that were just unreleased tracks that were pretty well produced and they were very well played. I'm just thinking of
the stuff, because all you guys have got some kind of benefit that you're doing for people, you know, Laurie's stuff and then the stuff with Stu Kimball mm-hmm. and stuff, you know, and we wanted also to mention that again before we go, even though you did it last week, I think it's very important to get that out and let the people know where they can support. Because like Sean said, there's a lot of people out there that's made some decent money and they love the band from that time period, and why not give it back in the ways that they should?
I was going to actually have the interview end with Laurie saying that, but we'll skip that real quick if you want. We'll go back to a couple other things after the fact. But Laurie, if you don't mind, I was going to ask you if you wouldn't mind just kind of mentioning again, for those who didn't maybe hear the first episode last week, the first the Billy Conway Artist Fund and also what's being done for Stu and Michelle.
Yeah.
So the Billy Conway Artist Fund was created after Billy Conway, who was the drummer in both Treat Her Right and Morphine, passed away coming up on, almost 5 years ago, which I can't believe.
No.
But Billy was incredibly generous. He had great creative generosity. So when you played music with him, he had a grin that was just filling up your gas tank with joy for playing music. And we created this program to try to pass that creative generosity on to the marginalized community of Native Americans, particularly in Montana where we lived. So our program seeks out and finds emerging contemporary music creators from any of the Native nations in Montana, and it's been a blast to do. And we've had two amazing artists so far that are we're just trying to amplify them and shine a light on them, and it's been great. So people can donate to the Billy Conway Artist Fund online. It's easy to find, www.billyconwayartistfund. And then Stu Kimball, our musical brother, who we love very deeply, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's several years ago, and his condition has he's declining rapidly and is not able to perform anymore. His wife has been his primary caretaker, and it's being sick in America costs an incredible amount of money, which it should not, but it does. It's like it will break you, and they are in the process of being broken by medical costs and hiring someone to come and stay with him and all of that. So on GoFundMe, there is a fundraiser for them specifically, and you can just go on and look for Stu and Michelle Kimball, and that's the fundraiser. It should be easy to find.
Cool.
Thank you for that, Laurie. Did it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean, for making a donation. I appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Let's turn to something that's more funny, to say the least. Since I don't want to get any morbid ending to this interview here, but I know that we talked in the past about each of you guys have stayed in the music business, so to speak. I know there was a break there for John for a while. I want to talk about that in a minute. But you guys have a different project you've been in, and I had to get back to you, Laurie, and please tell us about, I knew about Twyman and Orchestra Morphine, but the Chip Smith project. Please tell me about the Chip Smith project so we don't know about that.
The Chip Smith project was a band of siblings playing the music of their dearly departed father, who they loved in sort of an oversized way, kind of magical dude.
And father.
Yeah, and then, yeah. And after he died, you know, all the kids were musical. They formed a band. They're touring all over the place. And it turns out that their dear daddy had been quite a philanderer and had created lots of little sons. He only had boys. They you know, all over the country. So, and all of their mothers named them Chip, after Chip. So they did, when they started to discover each other, they would call each other, they would use a name that delineated what that person looked like or what they did. So there was, you know, Wood Chip was a forester and Potato Chip was a farmer. And then we had Chocolate Chip, who was actually played by Kemp Harris, who was an amazing, brilliant musician in Cambridge. So we played these characters and made up these songs and told everyone that our daddy wrote them, and people actually believed us. And it was hard for Billy in particular, because he's a true Midwesterner, and he had the hardest time lying. And people would be like, yeah, sure. Did your daddy really write all those songs? And he would just like look at me out of the corner of his eye, and I would shake my head, yes, yes, yes.
That's awesome.
That's a great story. Love that story, yeah.
So I do want to end up with you guys on the last show of the channel. Had to be difficult, I'm sure, and also pretty energizing to see the turnout, packed house, just, you know, amazing all around. But I do want to get a word from at least all three of you on that. But I do want to start with John. John, tell me about that. You know, I talked about a week or two ago about your sobriety and the motorcycle ride that led up to that. But I do want to have you kind of give us that story first to start off, if you don't mind, because it was pretty amazing.
Remember the old ad, you meet the nicest people on a Honda? TV ad from the 60s.
Yeah.
But I will say, you know, you meet the nicest people in sobriety, too. I've made friends for life since then. That started in 1985. In 1988, you know, the band was finishing up. Our last show was in October at the Channel. And I was just in this state of, like, shell shock. We finished a sound check in the afternoon, and I went back to Brighton, I think, and changed my clothes, did something. But I ended up at a meeting. A buddy of mine said, come meet me out here at the meeting at Waltham Hospital. So I got on my bike, rode out to Waltham Hospital, and he's waiting for me outside. This is unusual. And I said, hey, DJ. And this guy actually was a DJ at the Channel. So I said, DJ, what are you doing out here? He goes, oh, JR, you know, I wanted to just show you all these bikes. I said, yeah. He goes, these are all for you. I said, what do you mean? He goes, they've all agreed. They've come in to this meeting specifically just for you. We're going to ride you back into the show tonight. I said, oh man, thanks so much. So
wow.
I got to lead this pack of like 20 recovering crazy people. And we stopped at a gas station in Watertown. I topped them all off, and then we got back and we rode down, you know, the river and down the central artery and over to the Channel. And when we turned the corner onto, what's the name of that street? Whatever the street, Necco Street.
Necco.
Yeah, turned the corner on Necco Street. We saw the line was all the way out and all the way up to the corner. It was like, oh, that's gratifying. And I just like led the whole pack and just cut right through the line, right up to this double door that they're not supposed to open, banged on it for a while everybody was getting parked. And the guy opens up. I said, I'm with the band. He said, okay. And I said, no, these guys are with me. And he looked at me, he swallowed hard. He said, yeah? And I said, yeah. Yeah, because at that point, you know, who gives a fuck?
I love that story.
You know, Warren, we're going to get a thrashing from Warren, but so what? You'll never work in this town again, yeah? Anyway, it was a wonderful show of support. It really helped me a great deal, because emotionally I was just a zombie.
I appreciate you sharing that, Jonas. That's really an amazing story. Yeah. It just goes to show you. I mean, you know, I'm sure your headspace was all over the place. You know, the band, basically your life for the last, whatever, half dozen years at least, coming to an end as you knew it. And the fact that your sober brothers recognized there could be a chance there for you to slip, and they just came out and split. That's what a great story. That is so cool. Mm-hmm. So cool.
Yeah, and the rest of the night's kind of a blur. It comes to the audience chanting, don't break up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That was heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
Billy, what about you, the last show? Of memories, you know, on stage before the show, leading up to the show? Just kind of curious where your head was at and your recollection.
I'm not following that.
Yeah, I know.
That's amazing. It's beautiful. Yeah. I can't really process whatever it was that I was feeling at that point. I think for my role in Face to Face, I sort of felt like I had the whole weight of everything on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. And I remember playing and thinking about what our crew's going to do, because they were fantastic people, and worrying about what it sounded like. And it just, it went by in a blur. And I think by the time it was over, I was exhausted and just emotionally and physically spent.
Mm. That night was Ultra Blue, Stephen Paul Perry, and Brian Washburn with me and the boys, and MC was our favorite, Mark Parento.
Parento. Oh, my God.
Laurie, how about you?
That's me.
Thanks, Billy. Appreciate that. Laurie, what about your recollection or your, you know, the whole thing leading up to and after kind of deal?
The entire Boston Symphony Orchestra rode in a bus with me. And we showed up, and I pounded on the double door, and nobody would open it, so I had to kick it open with my Doc Martens.
Yeah. I love it.
That would have been Bootsmith. Yeah.
And Keith Lockhart conducted you through the crowd.
Yeah, exactly. He pointed where I should go. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It was, you know, I think, you know, like with everyone, it was a very, very emotional experience. And the crowd
was
amazing. They were just, it was love. It was an amazing, loving moment and in a life. And it was palpable, you know, like, and we loved our crowd, and there's no one like a face-to-face crowd. It's just like, when I bump into people now, still after all these years, like, oh my God, Bobby Sargent, I fucking love you. You know, it's like, there's nothing like it. And, you know, it makes me cry. It's really, it's like, you can't explain that to someone that's not from Boston, you know?
That's a very emotional one, that one.
Yeah.
You guys left quite the impression, for sure. It's great to reconnect and just kind of go back and relive some of those memories. And I'm glad that Dickie put this little format together to do this kind of stuff. It's just great to go back and visit with people like you guys who were a big part of the whole channel Boston music scene back in the 80s. And I really appreciate you guys making it. This has been a lot of fun for us, and I hope it's been for you guys as well.
Well, on that note, I just wanted to say that it's just about time for us to call it. And I have to say, it was enjoyable, the second part, because you released a lot more vibes on this one, even though it was the first one when you were opening up. Be able to post the first one, will be up on the Friday. Just so you can hear yourself.
Good. Thanks for having us.
The second one's better. You should post the second one first.
No, they're both good, Laurie. It's just some of the stuff that you guys have said today is really enjoyable, because it's you've opened up more, and not only that, you did start remembering things when you started mentioning a few things, like what Sean started on with the records. And then I started on with the people that played with you on that last night. and then recollection of you guys and how you got there and stuff. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, listen, this is too...
And I really believe we could not have done it without the channel. I mean, the channel was really important to our career, so I just want to make sure that we make that clear.
Yeah.
Especially last week.
I think that's a good thing to say, because it really was for a lot of bands, a lot of individual musicians, a lot of people came to see people that you didn't even know were there, and they were hiding in somewhere, and wow, this band's going to go. And then you get recognition with the radio stations the next day and this, that, and the other, and people are saying, did you go see them last night? They were fantastic. And
yeah, it was a perfect storm, a cultural perfect storm. That, a great club like the Channel, the Phoenix, BCN,
yeah.
You know. And it was, yeah, it was just a great time to be in a band. And we were very fortunate to be able to be there. But like I said, we had the goods.
Yeah, definitely. Really definitely. Yeah. And and the performance.
And even then it was a struggle.
But it was, this is
cool. You guys had a great run there, and we really appreciate you guys. Really,
yeah. We thank you very, very much. And this is Two Pints in the Corner with members of Face to Face closing. This is part two, by the way, and we're closing out on this one.